a roundup of the main business news from China and elsewhere. This is Global Business.
From CGTN headquarters here in Beijing, this is Global Business. I'm Michael Wong. The headlines we're tracking at this hour. Securing Hong Kong's status as the leading offshore RMB hub. China's Ministry of Finance issues this year's first batch of RMB treasury bonds in a special administrative region, worth nearly $1.7 billion. Flying high, China's first domestically produced large passenger jet, the C919, arrives in Malaysia for the first time. We'll explore the importance of the Southeast Asia market to China's aviation industry. And sticky prices. U.S. inflation in February comes in at a faster pace than expected, putting pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates high. Well, first up, China's Ministry of Finance has issued the year's first batch of renminbi-denominated treasury bonds in the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region. The issuance of 12 billion yuan, or around $1.67 billion, underscores China's commitment to enhancing the global stature of its currency and the Hong Kong SAR's position as a pivotal international financial hub. The finance ministry has been issuing RMB treasury bonds in Hong Kong now for 16 consecutive years, totaling over 300 billion yuan. Now in 2023, four batches of RMB treasury bonds totaling 50 billion yuan were issued in Hong Kong, a year-on-year increase of 117%. Well, the Hong Kong SAR government recently announced a $3 billion U.S. injection into its innovation and technology sector in its latest budget. The move is seen as a strong indication of the city's commitment to fostering high-tech industries and research and development with the aim of positioning itself as a global hub for innovation and tech. Our Patrick Falk has more.
Because we wear this around the place we want to scan. So lungs, liver, and kidney.
Justin Chan is co-founder and CEO of Gens Technology. The company makes low-cost, portable medical screening devices allowing people to scan critical organs for diseases in under a minute.
What we did was basically move it from hospital, like intensive care units, to very, very early stages. And it would make it a lot cheaper. We make it a lot more friendly to user. This is the way that we see could be a huge opportunity for the medical market.
Founded in 2017, the company has received total funding of around $2.5 million from public sector innovation grants as well as private partnerships. The product only came to market this year, but already Chan says the company will break even. Plans are in the pipeline to expand to different regions and grow profitability. Chan attributes Gens' early success to Hong Kong's positioning to foster startups, particularly when it comes to medical technology and innovation.
Obviously, there are quite a few grants that we can tap into, which really pushes on the early research to get you somewhere. And then we also have a really good infrastructure of medical system, not just on the hospital side, which is world class, but the academic support and the clinical trial support as well.
To support Hong Kong's development as a global tech hub, the government announced a raft of initiatives in its recently released budget, including a funding package totaling more than $3 billion.
One key initiative announced in the budget is a $1.3 billion scheme to support the development of health and life technology, AI and data sciences, new energy technology, as well as advanced manufacturing.
Under the plan, the government is prepared to match up to $25 million for enterprises in those sectors. It says that it expects to attract as many as 100 enterprises to invest no less than $25 billion in Hong Kong. It could be a crucial step towards diversifying the city's economy and developing new growth drivers.
Among investors like us, what we want to see is the hardware and talent come together. As a VC, of course, we must see profitability. So with this scheme, it will attract world-class investors to enter the foray. Also, so when we consider whether or not to invest and develop partnerships, we will be much more open. This is something that can really drive the economy.
Experts say Hong Kong also has the advantage of being able to tap into the manufacturing capabilities of the Greater Bay Area Development Zone for production. With such an ecosystem in place, the city's tech and innovation industries are poised to thrive. Patrick Falk, CGTN, Hong Kong.
All right, I want to bring it back now to Hong Kong and its role in the issuance of RMB sovereign bonds. And for more on that, I want to bring in Chu Qiang, a fellow at the Belt and Road Research Center of the Minzu University of China. Chu Qiang, thanks for joining us. So last year we saw record RMB-denominated treasury bonds being issued in the Hong Kong SAR. So give us the big picture first. How does the issuance of RMB-denominated sovereign bonds in Hong Kong boost the city's status as an international financial hub?
Well, last year, well, actually, in the past 3 or 5 years, we've been seeing the issuance of the RMB-denominated sovereign bond in Hong Kong has been rolling up, piling up in the in unprecedented speed. Well, last year we've been looking at 50 billion, yuan worth of the bond has been issued in Hong Kong. And this year, actually in the Q1, we have already seen about 12 billion renminbi worth of the bond has been issued in Hong Kong. And also, according to our knowledge this year, I think in mainland, the fiscal and also the financial expansion will also going to be phenomenal. So I think Hong Kong will be another very important destination to for us to collect the financial resources. And also, I think it's not only important for China, but also for the international investor. Hong Kong is also very important because in China, we know that in a very low position, and also the Chinese sovereign bond offers a rather competitive interest rate. So it's a real interest rate income for the sovereign bond issued in Hong Kong are very attractive for those investors who would like to anchor their portfolio to a stable value and also fight against the turbulence of their national financial risks. So I think, Chinese financial products issued in Hong Kong would be very, very, good because Hong Kong is a free capital market. You can easily buy in and sell out in this place.
Yeah. So we were just reporting that cumulatively now, China has issued for 16 consecutive years RMB-denominated sovereign bonds in the Hong Kong SAR. What's your outlook on the city's future as the leading offshore hub for the Chinese currency?
Well, I think the future for Hong Kong hub is going to be, phenomenon and, very promising. Number one, as we just discussed, the Chinese and renminbi anchored financial products would be very attractive still in the future. And also, secondly, I think already with the effort of the mainland government, also the Hong Kong regional government, we have already seen more 1 trillion renminbi worth of the renminbi piled up in Hong Kong, which made Hong Kong the largest offshore renminbi center in the whole world. So this is very important. So anyone who would like to invest in the assets of China or should get access to Hong Kong because, everybody says China has one country, two systems, not only a political arrangement, but also a financial arrangement. So in the mainland, we have not fully liberalized capital accounts, which guarantee the renminbi has a very stable anchor in value. But also, if you would like to have free access to the renminbi-denominated assets, for example, the sovereign bond, so which is not easy in the mainland China. So you can get access to the Hong Kong market. So on one hand, you get stability, but on the other hand, in Hong Kong, you get the liberty to buy in and sell off the renminbi-denominated assets. So you have both. So I think this arrangement will be very attractive to all the investors in the whole world. Hence, we'll solidify Hong Kong's position as the international financial hub.
And in terms of the future of finance, Chu Qiang, we know the Chinese mainland and Hong Kong both are at the forefront of developing what are called central bank digital currencies, or these CBDCs. So what does the combination of CBDCs and Hong Kong's role as the leading offshore RMB hub, what does this all mean for the Chinese currency's continued internationalization efforts?
Well, briefly speaking, Chinese mainland and Hong Kong, they have like billions or gazillions of financial international transfer happening on each day. Minutes, you're going to see money wiring and a wire out. Because it's, Hong Kong is not only serving Chinese financial market, but also international financial investors. But also, in the past, they used the SWIFT system, which is slow and very, very expensive. And also, we have the SIPS system, which is Chinese international payment system. But only among the Chinese banking systems, or their Hong Kong brand, the bridges. So if we want to reduce the cost and enhance the efficiencies, what we can do to, you know, bypass this SWIFT system or the SIPS system. I think this, the CBDC or digital currency system, would be a new solution. It's like you have the Hong Kong dollar token and also the renminbi token or the other country's currency's token. So you can make a pool in Hong Kong. And if you want to wire transfer the money or switch or exchange the currency to another one, you just exchange the token in your hand and immediately get the job done. So it can be very fast and reduce the cost. So I think that will further enhance the Hong Kong's position as international exchange and financial center.
All right, Chu Qiang, many thanks for your thoughts on all of that. Chu Qiang, a fellow at the Belt and Road Research Center at the Minzu University of China. Thank you. And still to come here on Global Business. Flying high, China's first domestically produced large passenger jet, the C919, arrives in Malaysia for the first time. We'll explore the importance of the Southeast Asia market to China's aviation industry.
The world economy as we know it is about to change. Global business reports highlight emerging markets, developing countries, and dynamic sectors worldwide. We feature top analysts and newsmakers to provide perspectives on every facet of business. From an on-the-ground perspective, we provide you with balanced and objective assessments. Fast, sharp, and insightful. Global business, only on CGTN.
Well, China's first domestically developed narrow-body jet, the C919, is set to be showcased at Malaysia's Subang Airport starting today. The aircraft, manufactured by the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, or COMAC, arrived at the airport on Tuesday as part of its ASEAN tour. COMAC's other aircraft, that's the ARJ-21, is already being used by major Chinese airlines, such as Air China, China Eastern Airlines, and China Southern Airlines, as well as Transnusa in Indonesia. The C919 and ARJ-21 recently made their debut outside of China at the Singapore Air Show, marking an important milestone for these Chinese aircraft models. And for more on China's first domestically developed large passenger jet, I want to bring in Yang Hangjun, Associate Dean of the School of International Trade and Economics at UIBE. Dean Yang, thank you so much for joining us. So why is China's C919 prioritizing the Southeast Asia market?
So I think, first of all, the airworthiness certification. So as you know, in September 2022, the C919 obtained the certification from the CAAC. And the CAAC has assigned bilateral agreements with 27 countries. That means once the aircraft obtains the CAAC certificate, it can operate and be recognized in these countries, including Canada, Australia, Russia, and so on. So most Southeast Asia countries recognize the certification from the CAAC, so which lays the foundation for the commercial operation of the aircraft in Southeast Asia. So second, I think the successful experience of ARJ-21 aircraft. So China's ARJ-21 has already been commercially operated by Indonesia's Transnusa Airlines, so accumulating certain market experience and reputation. So this will help promote and develop the C919 in the Southeast Asia market. Now third, I think there's also market demand. So the Southeast Asia region has a large population and a rapid economic development. So with a strong demand for the aviation market. So as the economy of the countries in the region continues to grow, the demand for air transport will also increase continuously. So the C919, a medium range, I think, trunk airliner, is suitable for meeting the travel needs in the region. Last but not least, I think policy support. With the signing and the implementation of the RCEP, by trade between China and Southeast Asia, will become even closer and larger. So this provides a favorable policy environment for the development of the aircraft in the region.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, Dean Yang, there's going to be robust demand and growth when it comes to air travel in Southeast Asia. So how can China's homegrown passenger jet better compete in this market with the likes of, let's say, Boeing and Airbus? What competitive advantages does the C919 have in this market?
So I think we started with, I think, the competitive advantages, you know, the aircraft C919 has. So besides the policy support I just mentioned, there are another, I think, two competitive advantages. The first, the C919 could offer a more competitive price compared with the Western counterparts like, you know, Boeing and Airbus, especially if Chinese manufacturers can leverage lower production costs due to local supply chains and economies of scale as the program matures. Second, providing efficient and cost-effective after-sales service could be also another significant advantage for the aircraft. If a COMAC can establish a strong network of maintenance, repair, and overhaul facilities in Southeast Asia, it could appeal to airlines looking for reliable support close to home, right? However, I think it's important to note that, you know, the C919 still faces significant challenges, including gaining international certification, building a reputation for safety and reliability, and overcoming the established market presence of Boeing and Airbus. So we need to accelerate efforts, you know, to obtain certificates from the European Aviation Safety Agency and the Federal Aviation Administration of the United States. And this will truly lead to the international market of the, you know, C919.
Mm. And Professor Yang, what does the development of a homegrown passenger jet industry mean for the future of China's own civil aviation industry when it comes to, let's say, innovation, when it comes to supply chains and positive spillover effects to other local industries?
Yeah, so I think, firstly, in terms of innovation, so the growth of the, you know, domestic passenger jet industry can stimulate technological innovation across various sectors of China's aviation industry. Companies like COMAC, we invest substantial resources in research and development as they design, manufacture, and test aircraft like the C919. This investment is likely to drive advancements in materials, propulsion systems, and avionics and other key areas, resulting in a stronger and more competitive civil aviation sector that is better equipped to meet global standards and compete internationally. The second, I think in terms of supply chains, the aircraft is a very complex supply chain. So the establishment of the homegrown passenger jet industry will require the development of the comprehensive domestic supply chains. This involves nurturing local suppliers and manufacturers for components such as engines, avionics, and structural parts. As the industry matures, it could lead to greater vertical integration and self-sufficiency, reducing dependence on foreign suppliers and enhancing the resilience of the Chinese aviation industry. And lastly, I think in terms of local industry, the expansion of the passenger jet sector can have a multiple effects on other local industries. For instance, it can drive demand for advanced manufacturing technologies, electronics, and software development. Additionally, the need for specialized training and education for, you know, in aeronautics, engineering, and the related fields can also stimulate growth in academic institutions and research organizations.
All right, Professor Yang, a pleasure as always. Yang Hongjun there, Associate Dean at UIB School of International Trade and Economics. Thank you. And I want to zoom in now on China's low-altitude economy, a term that's been written into this year's government work report as one of the new quality productive forces. Now, here in China, low-altitude flying generally refers to drones and aircraft that do not fly higher than 1,000 meters above ground. According to the Civil Aviation Administration, China's low-altitude economy was worth around $70 billion in 2023. The sector is expected to jump threefold and reach a market value of $280 billion by the end of this decade. So let's take a look at some of the numbers showing the size of China's general aviation market, which is a major part of the low-altitude economy. So far, there are nearly 3,200 registered general-purpose aircraft and nearly 700 operating airlines. The total flying hours reached 135 million hours in 2023. All right, and from flying taxis in the low-altitude economy, I want to bring it back to the high-altitude economy and traditional airplanes, where China's first self-developed narrow-body aircraft, again, that's the C919, indeed has now successfully completed its first international flight, gaining global attention in the process. Our Zhang Shixuan took a trip on a C919 to find out more.
If you were traveling in China by air before last year, chances are that you were on board a plane made either by Airbus or Boeing.
So things changed in May 2023 when C919, the first made in China large passenger jet, made its maiden commercial flight.
It was a trip from Shanghai to Beijing. And now every day there are more than 10 regular C919 flights between Shanghai and Beijing, Chengdu or Xi'an.
My first trip through a C919 flying to Beijing.
Last time I saw one of these aircraft was in December 2022, when the first of the jets was delivered to the China Eastern Airlines. And in just 16 months, another four had been delivered.
It's all happened very quickly and could shake up the entire commercial aviation industry.
The whole aviation industry will be dominated by three players: Airbus, Boeing, and China's aircraft.
My flight was almost full, and the crew told me that's the norm.
I've served on C919 flights to Chengdu, Beijing, and Xi'an. Almost all were full of passengers.
The aircraft maker COMAC and the airline have clearly made an effort to improve the passenger experience, right down to the design of the baggage compartments and the seats. COMAC has received more than 1,200 C919 orders. China Eastern Airlines is a big purchaser, having ordered 105 of the jets.
As you can see here, different groups of pilots are preparing for their flights, which are about to depart from Shanghai's Hongqiao Airport this afternoon. And among them, these three are busy preparing for a C919 flight from Shanghai to Beijing in about 2 hours.
I've been flying around 120 C919 flights for an accumulated 340 hours.
It seems what the plane is now waiting for is more international airworthiness certificates to be able to further open up its overseas market. But some experts say it's just a matter of time.
I think the good news is around the corner.
Tan adds that the market can find some clues from the ARJ21, the regional jet developed by COMAC. After years of development and experience in China, the regional jet was officially delivered to its first overseas customer in December 2022. And she expects the first international C919 buyers could be from the Southeast Asian market. Zhang Shixuan, ICS for CGTN, Shanghai.
Turning to the United States, where the cost of living in the U.S. rose in February. It was just a fraction, and inflation, though, remains on a downward trajectory. But the numbers are still tricky for the central bank and also President Joe Biden as he tries to win re-election on his handling of the economy. Our Owen Fairclough has more.
U.S. gasoline prices are at a four-month high at $3.39 on average for a gallon, or nearly 4 litres. Experts say a small jump is normal at this time of year when the warmer weather encourages drivers to hit the road. And gas prices are way down from their June 2022 record high. But the current spike has happened as core inflation overall rose in February, up 3.2% compared to 3.1% for January on an annual basis. Gas was up nearly 4%, while the price of air travel, clothing and eating out also rose. And if the cost of hospital services and prescription drugs drop, dental services rose. A mixed picture for President Joe Biden trying to win re-election, partly on trying to lower health costs.
Now it's time to go further and give Medicare the power to negotiate lower prices for even more drugs over the next decade.
If the latest numbers aren't ideal for Biden, they at least explain why the head of the Federal Reserve was cagey with lawmakers last week about when to cut its benchmark interest rate.
We'd like to see more data that confirm and make us more confident that inflation is moving sustainably down to 2%.
Given inflation is close to the Fed's target range, Jerome Powell is under pressure to cut the benchmark rate that's driven up mortgages, with overall accommodation costs one of the biggest rises in February's inflation numbers. Owen Fairclough, CGTN, Washington.
And for more on inflation in the United States, Bankrate's senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick shared his views on the latest U.S. CPI numbers. Take a listen.
If there's good news here, it is that food was flat, but shelter, which we all need to live somewhere, continues to rise. And so we're in the low 3% range on the headline year-over-year change on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, the main index measuring inflation at the retail level, but still in the high threes on the core rate, which excludes food and energy. But the Fed does not, let's say, make it a priority to measure the CPI relative to where it wants to be. It watches something else called personal consumption expenditures. And that number is in a lower range and getting closer to the Fed's 2% target. So they will look at these latest numbers and say, we know this is a bumpy ride for inflation, and this is yet another bump. But I think they have some confidence that there is sufficient restriction being put in place with high interest rates that they will get to their destination. And what we primarily need here are two things, time and patience. The Fed's medicine is in the system, and it's working its way through the system. But for consumers, businesses, investors, it's taking too long. But that's the way it's going to have to work, because we saw the worst inflation in a generation, as we all know, when the CPI year-over-year change was 9.1%, not in the low 3% range. So we've come a long way, and we still have some way to go. It's going to take time. It's going to take patience. They believe the job market is in a pretty good place. They believe the supply and demand of labor has come into better balance, as opposed to a couple of years ago when it felt as if, and indeed perhaps was the case, that workers held all of the power within their ability to negotiate or find new work. But right now, you know, the Fed is focused on the one part of its dual mandate that hasn't been working so well, and that's stable prices. And so many prices are stabilizing, but there were some outliers here, and there probably will continue to be. So in the latest reads, for example, if you go into the grocery store in the United States, you'll see beef prices are up, pork and chicken are down, sugar is up, whereas some of the other key prices are more stable. So ultimately, we want to see more decline in prices of services, because we are seeing goods prices coming down, and we need to see energy behave just a little bit better. But as you know, that's very difficult to predict, and it's very difficult to get through a prolonged period of time without some volatility, particularly with gasoline prices. Obviously, there's some urgency for policymakers at the elected level as well. But in terms of what the Fed is going to do, they have a meeting that's about a week away, and they've already said they're not going to move interest rates at the March 20th meeting. So to your point, Karina, we should look perhaps to the early part of the summer for the possibility of the first rate cut. What do we have to do between now and then? Get a lot more data that makes the Fed feel additionally confident that it can reduce interest rates, because it is getting closer to that promised land of the 2% inflation target in the PCE.
And with that, we're going to wrap up this edition of Global Business here on CGTN. I'm Michael Wong here in Beijing. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next time.